What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jackie Callan. Now, you may be familiar with Jackie. She is one of boxing's first and most successful female managers. Her life was the inspiration for the 2004 film Against the Ropes, starring Meg Ryan as Callan, in which she had a brief speaking role as a reporter. She also worked as a consultant for Mark Burnett's reality TV series, The Contender. We discussed a lot. We discussed her background as a publicist for Tommy Hearns, how she first came to meet him. We discuss her management of the great James Toney and what that was like. We discuss the movie. We discuss the couple books that she's written about her life and a great deal more. Regular listeners of this podcast will know the special place that boxing has in my heart. And it was such a pleasure to speak with someone as visible and well-known as Jackie Callan. And now I give you Jackie Callan. Okay, I'm here with Jackie Callan. Jackie, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be speaking with you. This is actually a conversation I'm wanting to have for a long time. I want to discuss, Jackie, obviously your early career. I want to track through your career as a boxing promoter, and I wouldn't mind saying a bit about the movie Against the Ropes as well.
But before
yes, ma'am. But before we do that, could you please tell our listeners who might not be familiar with you who you are and what you're doing now?
Okay, well, they call me the first lady of boxing because I kind of broke through the glass ceiling for females in the all-male world of boxing back in the late 70s. I got involved first as a boxing writer, then a boxing publicist, then a boxing manager slash promoter. So I've kind of worn a lot of hats in the boxing world, and not too many women have done as much as I've done for as long as I've been doing it, 45 years. So kind of puts me in the category of a pioneer. But prior to that, I was a journalist. I was a newspaper writer for a daily paper for 25 years. So I started covering entertainment, actors, singers, athletes, any celebrities. I did that for a long time and kind of segued into sports in the mid 70s, another first because there weren't any women covering sports back then. Maybe women's PGA or something, but not the general sports scene. And so that was a first for me as well. And through journalism, I kind of segued into the boxing world, did a story on a young fighter in Detroit, Tommy Hearns, who became a seven-time world champion and one of my closest friends. And that was my kind of introduction to the sport. And of course, when you start at the top, you get hooked because he was such an incredible talent. And just watching him develop and grow gave me a thirst for building a champion on my own. I thought, I think I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent, Jackie. Thank you. In tracking through your early career, as it were, pre-boxing career, I'd love to know, how was it that you came to interview Elvis Presley? And what was that experience like?
Well, Elvis didn't do interviews. That was the thing. Everybody wanted to interview him, but he just didn't do it. For whatever reason, Colonel Parker was very protective of him, and he didn't let him do very many interviews. So it was tricky. I had to figure out, how am I going to get to Elvis if he doesn't do interviews? So I talked to the mayor, because Elvis was appearing here on New Year's Eve that year, and I said, what if we give him a key to the city? You know, nobody's going to refuse a key to the city, and we'll give one to his manager also. And the only caveat being that I get to go with you. And they accepted the key to the city. And so that's what got me the proximity to be able to be with him and talk to him, get some pictures taken, and spend a little bit of time with him, which is really a treasured memory for me because so few people got that privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. How was he? Nice guy?
He was the sweetest, quietest gentleman. He seemed to be pretty drugged up the time I met him. He was the heavier, quieter Elvis by 1975, you know, That was 20 years into his career, so he wasn't the skinny, hip-moving, you know, sex symbol that he was in the 50s and 60s. But he was still iconic. And, you know, when you're around somebody that's that legendary, you can feel it in the air. There's a presence. And I've only felt that a few times. There's only been a few people that I felt had that aura about them, and Elvis was one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent, Jackie. What a great memory. I'd love to know. I'm chomping at the bit to discuss truly one of my favorite fighters. You mentioned him a minute ago, the great Tommy the Hitman Hearns. When did you first meet Tommy Hearns, and how did you develop a relationship with him?
I was sent to interview Tommy when he turned pro. I believe it was late 77, early 78, 1978. And he was a four-round fighter. This is a skinny kid, quiet. I mean, you couldn't get two words out of him. So after the fight, trying to interview him was like pulling teeth. Very, very soft-spoken. Eventually, I was able to get enough information to write an article on it. And the next time out, I wrote one on Emmanuel Stewart, who was his trainer manager. And then there was another fighter at that time named Mickey Goodwin, who was in the mix. He was one of the Krog fighters. At that time, there's only two of them. There was Tommy Hearns and Mickey Goodwin. And shortly after that, they got Hilmer Kenty, who moved to Detroit and joined the Krog team. And he actually became the first champion out of Krog before Tommy. But Tommy just stood out. There was something about him that really intrigued me. He was so quiet and soft-spoken and gentle. But when he climbed through those ropes and he got in there to actually fight, a different person emerged. You know, he had that stare that was chilling, and he went out there to take your head off. And I mean, he was all business. Then the second he came back through the ropes, he was the sweetest guy on the planet. So I was pretty fascinated by that dichotomy. How can you be both of those people? And I found out later that a lot of boxers are like that. They're very sweet, kind, gentle people. But when they get in the ring, totally different animal.
Yeah. Yeah. The psychology of fighters fascinates me. Actually, I was thinking as you were talking about another hitman, in fact, Ricky Hatton, who has much the same psychology. Everyone describes him as super sweet, super nice, but don't tell that to Kostya Zoo, right?
That's just it. Some fighters have the ability to turn that switch. And when they're in the ring, they're a different person completely. And it's just, you know, I think it's a rare quality because most people are the same in and out. But there are those fighters that can turn the switch. Now, guys like Mike Tyson and, you know, those type of fighters are the same. That's who they are. But Tommy's just a sweet, gentle guy. He's a wonderful friend.
That's wonderful. So I've never been to the Kronk Gym. When I was boxing, it was certainly on my bucket list to have a training session out there. Sadly, I never took the chance to capitalize on it. And I'd love to know, can you describe what Kronk Gym was like? And also, I'd love for you to maybe just talk about what it means to boxing.
Well, the Kronk Gym, the original one, is no longer there. The building is gone. But it was in the basement of a recreation center. And you walk through the recreation center, and there were all the rooms where they had different, you know, activities and classes. And then there was a whole basketball court. But down the basement was this dingy little gym, and it was hot. They kept it about between 95 and 100 in there. So you would start sweating as soon as you got there. And because of the heat and the moisture and being down in the basement, there were cockroaches. There was it was just a very, you know, gritty atmosphere. It wasn't, you know, coming from the suburbs, it was a big change for me. And, you know, the minute you got in there, there was the smells, the sounds, just a different air in that gym. The competitive attitude of all the fighters there was the strongest I've seen. You could cut it with a knife. They were there to work, and they were there to fight, and they were there to brawl. So some of the sparring sessions at Krog were a lot harder than the actual fights. So getting ready for the fights was the war. And then by the time they got into their actual fights, it was nothing compared to what they'd been through in the gym. So the air there was very thick, and there was a lot of, I won't call it hostility or animosity, but there was rivalry there. Mm. And so you could really feel that. And you had to be on top of your game to spar at Krog. When fighters came from other gyms to get work there, They got yelled at. They got taunted. They got teased and harassed. And you had to be tough. If you were going to make it at the Kronk Gym, you had to be tough. If not, they'd run you out of there. And believe me, with your tail between your legs, and you wouldn't be coming back any day soon. I've seen them run a lot of fighters out.
Yeah, no, I have no doubt. The two cities would have to be, I think, Detroit, and I guess I would add Philadelphia.
Yes.
For the hyper-competitive.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. Joe Frazier and those gyms back in his era, you know, Bernard Hopkins, all those guys, they were tough too. And it was the same thing. You come to those gyms, you're going to get tried. And if you can't hang,
you're out. Jackie, I'd love if you could please give me some background on how you came to be involved with James Toney. And specifically, I'd love to know the background of his fight with Michael Nunn and your part in it.
Oh, for sure. Well, the first fighter I actually managed was Bobby Hitz, a heavyweight out of Chicago. And when Bobby and I were at a gym that we were working at, we saw this kid sparring, and I was very impressed. I just said, wow, you know, he's what a defense. I mean, the way he rolled that shoulder and picked off shots, I went, he's really hard to hit. That's a great asset. And I watched him for a few days, and then just listening to Jim talk, I heard that his manager had been killed in a drug deal. And so he didn't have a manager. So I approached him and asked him if he was interested in a manager. And we talked, and I bought out his contract that was remaining with the other fighter. His estate still had the contract, and the rest was history. We just clicked. And working with him was a great challenge, because along with great talent, sometimes comes great challenges. And one thing I'll say, James fought anybody, anytime. He never questioned who he was fighting. He didn't even care to see a tape. Same as Tommy Hearns. They're just cut from a different cloth. They're fighters. They're gladiators. They're warriors. They don't care who they fight. They know that you have to beat the best to be the best. So he had fought, James had fought Murky Sosa, which was a tricky fight, in Atlantic City, and won that fight. And that opened him up for bigger fights. Michael Nunn, who was then the champ, second to Nunn, you know, the number one middleweight at the time, he was supposed to fight Stevie Collins, who got injured. So there was an opening, and they offered it to James. So I believed he could win. I thought it was a great opportunity. A lot of people questioned that. They thought, why would you take that fight? You know, it's a risky fight. It's in his backyard. It wasn't like the fight was in Vegas or on neutral territory. It was in Michael Nunn's hometown. And they said, you're going to have to knock him out to beat him. And it's just a very risky fight. You're not even 50-50 if you had the odds. And it turned out James was a 20-1 underdog. I wish I'd bet the fight. But back then, you know, you can bet on your own fighter, kind of superstitious. But I said, we're going to do it, and we're going to win by hook or by crook. And we had a group of maybe 30 people that came from Detroit, you know, with trainers and cornermen and, you know, sparring partners, family members. And there was 8,000 of his fans, and like I said, about 30 of ours. So we were very, you know, overpowered in every way. You know, he got the nice hotel suite. We got put at a motel somewhere. Everything was about Michael Nunn. This was his backyard. And if you saw the fight, you knew that he was dominating, and he was actually beating James more than halfway through the fight. And then James turned it around. And he got that powerful left hook knockout in the 11th round, which, you know, changed his life and my life and, you know, put women on the boxing map, that we were capable of making a decision like that and being right, because everybody second guessed me.
Right, right. That's wonderful. Just out of curiosity, can you recall what the cards were like at the 11th round? Was James behind on all cards?
He was. But, you know, he started coming back in the 7th, 8th, had a great 9th round. And by the 11th, you know, he was just on his game. And I think Michael Nunn started to realize, hey, this isn't so easy.
Right.
And, you know, and actually at the end, the crowd was with us. They were cheering, and they were, it was like they were happy to see the underdog. Even though their own guy lost, it was like the little engine that could, you know, here's this guy that came from Detroit with his little tiny entourage against this giant of a champion. and won. So it was a wonderful night. It really was. It was memorable. You know, for our team, it like I said, it put us on the map.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to know if you can recall, you know, so he gets the belt in the ring post knockout. Can you recall what you guys did after? Did you party it up, or was it more mellow night?
Well, we were, you know, in the Quad Cities, which is not exactly New York or LA, and everything closes early. So we had to drive way out of town somewhere to find a Denny's that was open 24 hours so that our group of 30 people could find a place to go and celebrate. And it was a non-alcoholic pancakes, it was probably 1 a.m. by then. And it was just the joy of knowing that we did it, that we were a team. We worked together hard. He sparred hard and trained hard. Bill Miller was an incredible trainer. Mm-hmm. He knew how to bring out the best in a fighter. And I couldn't give him enough credit. May he rest in peace. But he just knew how to get into a fighter's head. And he was able to talk James through that fight and get him going halfway through. He was able to dig deep and bring out whatever was necessary to win. So we were just a happy team.
That's awesome. I feel these days that James Toney is underrated. People tend to forget what a defensive machine he was. I mean, before Floyd Mayweather, the Philly Shell belonged to Toney, in my view. What do you think, if you had to assess James Toney's legacy in the boxing realm, what would you say?
Well, you just said it better than I could have, but his defense was legendary. He was a throwback. He fought more like the older fighters did in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And his stance and the way he could see a punch coming and block it and pick it off and counterpunch. I mean, he just was a smart, smart fighter. And I loved watching him because of that. You know, it's almost like he could anticipate what was coming. And that shoulder would roll and he'd block it. Yep. And it was so hard to hit him. Right. You just did it. It was just instinctive with him, you know. And I've seen many fighters try to emulate that. And it's just a natural thing that either you have or you don't. And he had it. And I'm glad he's in the Boxing Hall of Fame. He deserves that. I was so happy that they inducted him. And he is one of the greats. And for me to have found this little kid, this little 19-year-old kid in the gym, and have been able to make the right moves and carefully, you know, push him through fight after fight until he got the title. That's such an honor that I'll always have, because it was just great timing, a great combination, good trainer, good, amazing, good fighter, and lucky management skills, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful, Jackie. So my last name's Cohen, right? And that leads me to want to ask the question of what it meant to you for James Toney to put the Star of David on his trunks.
You know, Bronco McCart did it too. A lot of my fighters did. And I just felt that was a little touch of spirituality, a little extra good luck. And Tommy Hearns did it for me for one of the fights. And I asked, why is that star there? And he said, for you. You know, and I was so touched by that. And then when I started managing myself, I thought maybe I'll resurrect that star, David, and use it for good luck. And it certainly worked. You know, our team of fighters, and I had as many as a dozen at one time, mm-hmm. they all wore it. And we had such a winning record. It was almost uncanny. Uncanny. Nobody lost. Everybody won their fights. And I don't know if it was just their great skill, my clever matchmaking, or just the gods looking down saying, I'm going to give her a lot of wins. But we were really unbeatable for several years. And, you know, you can attribute it to the star if you want to. I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My last question on James Toney, then I want to jump to other topics. But I'm just curious, you know, you hear about working with fighters and managing ego, right? And a lot of times these things run concurrent. The more talented and successful a boxer is, the more ego they have. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts or philosophies on how you manage a fighter's ego, specifically James Toney's, who's, you know, it's not a secret. He's, you know, not unegotistical. I think that's a fair way of putting it.
Well, you know, Being a female, I think I handled it differently than a male manager would. They could have come to blows with him many times. But I think being a mother, and I have kids the same age as him, there's that maternal thing that kicks in. And I think a lot of times I was able to just talk him down and, you know, work it out. And the times that that didn't work, he just had to express his anger the way he did, whether it was to break a mirror in the gym, or which he would replace, or throw the scale through the wall because he didn't like the weight. You know, he always fixed it. Let's put it that way. And we're still good friends today. I just had lunch with him earlier this year. Oh. And, you know, when you shared the 6 years that we shared traveling the world and fighting in so many different venues against so many different fighters, you develop a closeness, and that doesn't go away. You know, you're sort of a part of each other's lives. And James's personality is not unique to boxing. Like I said, some of them are sweet as pie when you get out of the ring. And some of them are the same in the ring as out. They have that anger, that hunger. That's what makes them great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you have a Hall of Fame boxer like that, you deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to know, you kind of spoke to it a minute ago there, Jackie, as a woman coming up, trying to make your way in, let's call it a hyper-masculine environment like boxing. I'd love if you could talk about maybe some of the early challenges you had. Did you face a great deal of sexism early on?
Well, you know, there wasn't a Me Too movement back then. You know, it was there. It didn't have a name. And, you know, I was one of the lucky ones because I did not handle it the way some women do. I was already 32 by the time I got into it, and I had two kids. I was married. I was settled in my life, and it didn't really bother me to the point that I ever reacted negatively or reported anybody. Or I treated it a lot with humor. And to me, I would make a joke of it. If somebody did something that I thought was a little bit, you know, inappropriate, I would just laugh it off and say, "You're talking to me?" You know, or I would say, "I would love to do that, but I have to wash my hair. I got to do my nails. Can I have a rain check?" You know, there's a lot of ways that I handled it without acting offended. A lot of times I would just say, "Wow, I'm really flattered. You know, that's really sweet. But, you know, I'm married and it's just not going to work. But, you know, I take that as a compliment." So I would try to play it off either with humor or by just deflecting it. And it never made any enemies for me. And, you know, the times when they'd try to make me feel uncomfortable in a locker room where somebody would expose themselves or whatever, you know, I would just say, "Look, I've got two kids at home and a husband. There's nothing you've got I haven't seen." But, you know, not bad. I give it a 5. You know, I would joke around. And so it was kind of not as hard for me as it could have been if I was more sensitive. But I think I've developed a thick skin and I've learned how to handle that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, Jackie. Thank you. I'd love to know what is the role that charity plays in your promoting philosophy? I understand that you encourage your fighters to take up a cause that they greatly appreciate.
Well, we did a lot of things as a group, as a gym. We would feed the homeless. You know, we'd go down to the shelters, you know, on Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we'd visit children's hospitals, and the fighters would interact with the patients. The ones who had belts, we'd bring the belts and we'd let the kids take pictures with the championship belts. That was a lot of fun. The kids really loved that. I did a lot of work when I lived in LA with battered women. And sometimes the fighters would come down and interact with the women in a very gentle, nice way. But I just think it's important to give back. And so I always encourage that. When we'd be in New York training and we'd walk down the streets, I always give everybody a lot of singles to hand out. If we saw somebody that needed it, we'd have it. And I just think it's important, you know, and the more successful you are, the more you have to give. And it's all relative. The world's not about you.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful, Jackie. Thank you. Do you remember when exactly it was that you got the moniker of the First Lady of Boxing?
Yeah, it was probably, I'm going to say 1992. It was after James won that fight. Pretty sure Ring Magazine gave it to me, and it was the cover of one of the articles, said First Lady of Boxing. And I was so honored by that, so touched by that. And it just stuck, you know, and it's been 30 years now. And so I'm kind of used to it. But it's just, it's a wonderful tribute to know the first, you know, that you kind of made a mark for yourself. Other women have tried. There's other women, obviously, in boxing, but there still hasn't been anyone that's come along that's managed champions like I have and run their own gym like I have. So it must be either not that appealing to women or hard, or maybe they're just not interested. But I thought by now there'd be a lot of others, and there aren't.
Right. Yeah, I think I would feel as you do. If you could give someone who's just starting off in the boxing promotion business some advice, what do you think you'd say to them, Jackie?
Well, the first thing I would tell male or female is to be fair. Always be fair to the fighters. They're the ones that do all the work. Some of these promoters treat the fighters like just interchangeable cattle, like you're gone, we'll get someone else. You lose, we'll replace you. These are people and they're working hard and they need to get your respect. And if you give it, you'll get it in most cases. Obviously, develop a thick skin. You can't let anybody's opinion or what they say bother you. I would also tell people, don't burn a bridge, because you might have to work with that same person again. And you may have an argument or disagreement, and you may have some kind of a falling out. But keep it peaceful, because in this business, it's a pretty small business. You may have to work with that same fighter, that same manager, that same promoter again. So if you can, keep it amicable, agree to disagree. But when you burn too many bridges, you find yourself alone in this business, and that's not a good place to be.
Yeah, yeah. It can be a howling wilderness for someone that has all enemies.
You're right, 100%. That's why I've lasted 45 years, I think, because I mind my business, I do my job, I try to get along with everybody. If we have a disagreement, let's sit down and talk about it. Doesn't mean we're enemies. We might just disagree on something. But, you know, conduct yourself with integrity, and I think you'll be fine. But you got to love the business, because there's days where you're going to want to quit. Everybody says that. Why am I doing this? You know, why am I still doing this? But we love the business.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's well said, Jackie. So I have some of my favorite boxers. You actually mentioned Bernard Hopkins earlier. I adore him for his craftsmanship, his longevity, his work ethic. And I'm just curious, do you happen to have a favorite fighter?
Well, you know, aside from the ones I've worked with who are always top of my list, obviously for personal reasons, you know, I always loved Muhammad Ali. He was such an amazing, sweet guy. I've known him probably. I met him the first year I was in boxing. So I would run into him all the time at fights. He came to the premiere, you know, debut fights of some of my fighters. And he was such a gentleman and always funny. And he was just always one of my favorites. Of the ones I never met that I watched, I loved Sugar Ray Robinson. Oh my gosh, I could watch him every day. He was so awesome at everything. I loved him. I loved Larry Holmes' jab.
Yeah.
I used to watch his fights and say, wow, that guy can really jab. I loved that. Certainly, I loved Tyson in his heyday. I loved that knockout power. I thought Evander was slick as can be. Mm-hmm. Much respect to Sugar Ray Leonard, who's a personal friend and also, you know, an awesome Hall of Fame boxer. So there's so many of them, you know, for different reasons. You know, you'll love someone's offense, of Marvin Hagler, their toughness, or you'll love someone's slickness. Mayweather's a very slick boxer. So you can find something to like in a lot of these guys, but I'm just such a fan of boxing that I like so many of them. I used to love Jake LaMotta. He was like an uncle to me. I used to love watching his old films. He was a real animal, and he just, he got in there and he got hit so many times to get in one punch, but he was fun to watch. So, you know, they're all good in their own way. Who's your favorite?
Yeah. The one I keep coming back to, I think, is Bernard Hopkins. I love
how well-rounded guy, isn't he? And he fought till a very advanced age and was still great.
He beat, I think it was Tavoris Cloud for the WBA title, 48 years old, a just like insane, preposterous age. Like for non-boxing fans, that simply doesn't happen. There was a time when, you know, when Ali was fighting, if you were 32 and fighting, you were considered middle-aged.
Oh, absolutely. I remember when I was working with Bobby Hintz, my first fighter, he was 25. And I remember people saying, oh, he's already 25.
Right.
You know, you want to get someone 18. So, I mean, by the time they were 35, that was old. That's an old fighter at 35. So to even think you're fighting at 48. And when Foreman came back at 50, it's like, what? You know, 50-year-old man fighting. But the sport has changed and evolved. And I think all of us are living longer, staying in better shape. So they've kind of stretched that age a lot from where it was 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, I totally agree, Jackie. Yeah, I think my favorite fight, the one I find I just keep coming back to, is I don't know if you saw Hopkins's fight against Tarver.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
It was a masterclass. That right cross just down the pike.
Yeah. Masterful performance. That's exactly the word I was going to use, too. But those are the classic fights. You know, you look back and a boxing fan can watch some of these classic matchups and see what real fighting is. I mean, I'm not saying today's fighters aren't good. They are. But I don't think they're fighting each other at the same level that they used to. Or we'd be seeing, you know, the fights like Crawford and Spence and the ones we really want to see. You know, years ago, that fight would have been made a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a whole other podcast about matchmaking, isn't there?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah, you're right about that.
I once met Roger Mayweather, in fact, back when I was a deputy commissioner for the Minnesota Boxing Commission. And it was probably the first time, Jackie, I was really starstruck, you know, meeting a boxing figure. I'm just curious, was there a figure that you've met in your time where they just stopped you in your tracks?
You know, I would probably have to say Ali. You know, he was just, to me, he epitomized, that's the word, epitomized boxing. He was the man, you know, Ali. And to this day, you know, he is the guy that everybody looks up to. And meeting him was everything you would think that it would have been. He, like I said earlier, he was a sweet, gentle man. And I think I was kind of awed meeting him. And I met him, you know, he was already 10 years past the Olympics and all that. But he was a bigger than life figure. I don't think I've met anyone else in boxing that I looked up to the way I looked up to Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, well, that's a good one for sure. So I've had the pleasure now, Jackie, of interviewing several people that have had movies made about their lives. And I love asking this question. How surreal is it to have a movie made about your life? And what was that experience like?
Oh, it's very, very flattering. It's a wonderful thing to have somebody think you're interesting enough to do a movie about. I wasn't happy with the way mine turned out. But it's still an honor. And I think that the message to the movie that you can do whatever you want to do and just believe in yourself is a very solid, strong message. They didn't stick to the real story, which was disappointing to me. But nevertheless, you know, like it's an honor the way you said it. It's definitely something to be proud of. And hopefully someday they'll do a documentary of the real story. And I'm sure I'll like that more.
What about the movie was incorrect that stands
most
out to you?
Most of it. In the movie, I was single, and in real life, I was married. I had two sons. They had me single with no children. I was in Detroit. They had the city as Cleveland. They had my fighter stolen from me before he won the title, which isn't what happened at all. They had me buy my fighter for a dollar. I never bought my fighter for a dollar. Just a lot of things about it were Hollywood. But again, the message was there. And if that encouraged anybody, then it did its job. You know, it's just me and the people that I know that realized that it wasn't the real story. But to anybody going to see it as a movie, it was entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Excellent. Thank you, Jackie. What prompted you to write the books Hit Me With Your Best Shot and Between the Ropes?
Well, Hit Me With Your Best Shot is basically just a self-help book. We all live our life like it's a fight. You can get knocked down, but you got to get back up, get the right people in your corner. It was just sort of comparing life to a boxing match. And it's all survival of the fittest and rah, rah, rah. You can get knocked down, but you got to get back up. Between the Ropes was the real story of my life up to that point. And I wanted to set the record straight. I didn't do a lot of promoting. It was mostly for my friends and family, to be honest. But now there's a book coming out called Against the Odds, the Jackie Callan Story. It's written by Peter Mann out of England. And that should be coming out. It's supposed to have been out by now. So I don't know what the hang up is, but that's supposed to be coming out of England, the UK. And that's a authorized biography. So hopefully he did a good job.
Awesome. I've asked this question to your friends, Barry Tompkins and Steve Farhood on the podcast. I'd love to get your answer. What's the greatest fight that you've ever seen?
Wow, that's a great question. I kind of loved the Arturo Gatti, Mickey Ward trilogy.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed those fights. You know, I thought they were edge of your seat, you know, kind of really competitive matchups. So, I mean, I liked so many of them. In 45 years, I could go on and on and on and on.
Sure.
But I would say that was one of my favorite fights, those three.
That ninth round in the first fight is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. That no one gets up from a body shot like that. It just doesn't happen. When Hopkins did it with De La Hoya, it was the first time De La Hoya was ever knocked out.
that's right. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been some real classic fights. And you look back and you just say, wow, you know, how did that person get back up? Or how did they turn that fight around? Or it was toe-to-toe the whole time. So boxing is a thrilling sport. It really is. Yeah. When it's done right, you see a well-matched fight, it keeps you on the edge of your seat. And unfortunately, there's a lot of one-sided fights because on the way up, when people are building their records, they tend to fight inferior competition. I mean, that's just the way it goes. You're not going to fight for the title your first fight.
Right. And
so it's when you get to the very top, when the best fight the best, that you see some really, really great matches.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't want to use the word tomato can because I don't want to be disrespectful. But, you know, you do pad your record as you're on your way up. In case you're curious, Tompkins and Farhood both told me the first Arguello prior fight.
Oh, those were great, too. Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. If I hadn't just seen Mickey Ward recently, I probably might not have thought of him right away. Yeah. But his fights were amazing. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, as a boxing fan, there's a lot of classic fights to dig up and watch and say, wow.
Yeah.
Boxing has given a lot to its fans.
No, it truly has. I mean, Mickey Ward is on my dream list of interviewees. So hopefully one day. So just a few questions left, Jackie. I hope that's okay. Thank you so much. What are you working on currently, Jackie?
Oh, a bunch of things. Working on a TV show that's a reality show called Queen of the Ring. And I'll have more information on that coming up. I'm working with a string of female boxing gyms called Striking Beauties Boxing Gyms for Women. Right now, there's two of them in the Boston Providence area, and we're looking to franchise around the country. So that's exciting. I do motivational speaking, which I love. You know, I love to get out and talk to people. And that's something that means a lot to me. And of course, the book coming out soon, looking forward to that. And I work with Mike Quan Williams right now, who's 19-0. And he's at 140 junior welterweight. He just won another fight. And, you know, I have high hopes for him. He's with Lou DiBella. And I think we've brought him up right to this point. He's had 20 fights. He's 19-0-1. And I'm looking for this coming year to be a big year for him. And then I have a fighter here, Sam Rizzo. He's just only going for his fifth fight. He's just starting out at 130, but he's a promising little boxer, you know, and I spread myself out now. I don't have 12 fighters. And, you know, I pick the ones I want to work with who I think have a lot of promise. And that gives me time to do these other things. And that makes me happy. To stay busy is important to me. You know, I like to have more than one project going at one, you know, at the same time. So right now I'm excited about all of my projects. I'm excited about my Quan. And I'm happy to be on this show.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. I appreciate that. No, it was an honor. Jackie Callen, where can people find out about you?
Well, on Facebook, I'm Jackie Kaplan Callen. I use my maiden name in the middle there because my other account got hacked. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. And I do answer all the emails that I get at JackieCallen@AOL. You can tell how long I've been online. AOL is like the oldest address you can have, right?
Yep.
I'm an OG.
I did notice that when I found your email address. Well, Jackie, this was a real pleasure. Like I said, I'm wanting to talk with you for a long time. So I really appreciate you taking the time for me.
Oh, my pleasure. I was looking forward to this. And you ask really good questions. Oh. You know, you bring up a lot of good subjects, which makes an interview so much more fun than the average. So I give you kudos for that. And anytime you want to talk about matchmaking and some of these other topics, just let me know.
Oh, fantastic, Jackie. Thank you so much. I think you might expect to hear from me.
I would love that.
Thank you, Jackie, so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was nice talking to you.
You too, Jackie. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.